Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello, and welcome to Little Gold Men, the podcast that reminds you incessantly that award season is a year-round affair, and not just something that happens from September to February, although it's almost September, and so it really is starting to heat up. I'm Mike Hogan, digital director of Vanity Fair. I'm here with Richard Lawson, our film critic.
Hello.
And a special host today, Hollywood editor Hilary Busis.
Hi, thank you for making me feel special.
Right?
Yes.
You are very special. We feel special that you're here. We have a really exciting show lined up for you today. We're going to talk about a movie that Richard actually liked.
It's been a rare feat. It's been months maybe since that happened.
We're going to talk about another movie that Richard liked.
Yeah.
Did you like it? So the first one is Pete's Dragon.
Yeah.
The second one is the Paul Verhoeven film.
Kind of a strange double feature.
Yes. Yeah.
One for kids, one very much not for kids.
Mm-hmm. And then we're going to go dig into the New York Film Festival lineup and other fall release stuff that is really starting to whet our appetites for a real award season. Hollywood is going to start actually releasing good movies. That's the promise of this time of year. And then we will relitigate the 1982, I believe, Best Picture race when Chariots of Fire beat out a group of films that included On Golden Pond and Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, it was a crazy year.
That's it. I've just laid down all of our cards right onto the table.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Pete's Dragon. Not directed by the David Lowery who founded Camper Van Beethoven and Cracker. I don't know if anyone, I might just be aging myself. Do you guys even know what I'm talking about?
That's the other
David Lowery.
Like Cracker's the guy who invented Crackers?
There was a band called Cracker in the 90s. I remember Camper Van Beethoven. Sam knows what I'm talking about. Sam,
I know
Sam's
Uncle
like,
Cracker.
Not really. Okay. Guys, this was early alternative rock stuff. Anyway, you probably would recognize one of their songs. But this is the David Lowery who directed Ain't Them Body Saints.
Yeah. He's like an indie kind of newcomer-ish.
And lived in the back seat of his car for years making tiny micro-budget movies. And now Disney was like, here's eight figures.
Yeah, I would guess. Yeah.
Make a movie. So tell us about it. What happened?
Yeah, it's another in this kind of exciting thing where Disney and a couple other studios are taking these big risks on kind of indie directors to take beloved cultural properties and do something cool with them. I mean, they're doing that a lot with like the Marvel movies. But yeah, so, you know, Pete's Dragon, 1977, mostly live action, somewhat animated movie. It's beloved, I think, by a certain generation of people my age, a little older, about a boy who's kind of, well, in that movie he's a runaway, but in this one his parents are killed in an accident and he ends up living in the woods with his,
it's kind of a Tarzan Jungle Book thing.
It's a Tarzan Jungle Book kind of thing, and he has a friend who's a dragon who kind of is his pal and his caretaker, and this movie, you know, this risk that Disney took really pays off because it's beautiful. It's like a really great movie for both kids and adults. It's the rare one that I think I mentioned in my review that doesn't just kind of please kids with its silly stuff and then, you know, throw a couple little ironic over the kids' head jokes to the adults. It actually kind of, it reaches kids and adults in a very sort of organic, sincere way, which is, is pretty cool.
So I saw Ain't the Body Saints at Sundance, I think, right?
Sure, yeah.
And that is not a movie where walking out of it, I'd be like, let's give this guy a Disney movie, right? I mean, what is there a thread between the two things?
I honestly don't know. I mean, my guess would be that...
Well, just for people, if they haven't seen it, Ain't the Body Saints, really dark sort of Western...
Crime romance kind of a thing.
Crime romance.
Like Rooney Mara, right?
Rooney Mara and Casey Affleck, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And brilliant. But anyway, so this is a totally different tone. This is a different mood.
Yeah, this is... I'm sure that, you know, I think that David Lowery is the right age to have liked the 1977 version. And I'm sure when this project was kind of brought up, he was like, oh, I have a pitch for that. And then, like, sold it. And it really, really works. I mean, and I think that in a summer that has been awful for movies, by my estimation,
especially sequels and reboots.
Yeah, no, exactly. And, you know, like, compared to Ghostbusters, which I'm not a fan of, other people are more of a fan of that movie than I am, but like, this is just so refreshing because it takes a kind of a cultural property that, you know, and doesn't revive it cynically. It doesn't try to just hit the same beats. It does something really new and exciting. So I'm really pleasantly surprised.
But also, Pete's Dragon wasn't a Ghostbusters level
phenomenon,
right? It was this kind of like weird, quirky...
Yeah, I wonder if part of the reason this movie succeeds is because the original has, you know, people have fond memories of it, but they aren't so in love with it that they are unprepared to see a new version of it.
Built their lives around it the way that apparently some people did with Ghostbusters.
Yeah, apparently. No one on the internet is being like, you're destroying my childhood by remaking Pete's Dragon.
They are certainly
saying that about Ghostbusters.
So, but the original was actually nominated for 2 Oscars, Best Original Song and Best Music.
The song was You Light Up My Life, is that right? It was
Candle on the Water.
Candle on the Water, that's right. But You Light Up My Life is in Pete's Dragon as well.
Oh, it is? Okay, all right. That I didn't even realize.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's right.
I think You Light Up My Life won the Oscar, and Candle on the Water was also nominated.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So
I was just reading up on Pete's Dragon.
Oh, yeah.
Well played.
Yeah, Shelley Winter sings a song. You know, it's
good to have someone new. They actually do some homework before they come in here. All right. So any Oscar possibilities here for the new one?
I think that it's a sort of smaller August release. I think it would probably be a tough sell. The special effects are really subtly done. Like, the dragon is CGI and is... But unlike the original, he's visible for most of the time. And it's really, really well done. And I think that bringing a small indie director into this big kind of thing, like, I think he understands not making the special effects really intrusive. Like, they're just kind of organic to the movie. So I think that could be one. It's got a bunch of original songs in it, or I guess they're kind of remakes of songs. So maybe that. But no, I don't think so. I mean, I think hopefully... its legacy, if not, it won't be awardsy. It'll just be like a nice movie that kids and parents like for, you know, the next few years or something. I don't know. It's a little bit smaller than you want from this bad movie summer. You want like to end on something big, but it's not that, unfortunately. But
so if your friends insist on going to see Suicide Squad, you can just go over to Pete's Dragon.
Right. Well, that's the other thing is I saw Pete's Dragon the day after I saw Suicide Squad. And I was like, so like, ugh, I hate movies. Like, I know this summer is awful. And I went just like by myself and some afternoon to Times Square and then I just wept through this like movie.
So Bryce Dallas Howard gets to wear pants in Pete's Dragon.
She does.
Have
She's
to walk
not
around
in
the forest in stilettos and
shiny
fishnets.
Blue underwear. No, Bryce Dallas Howard is so good in the movie. And you know, I was joking.
Former Vanity Fair intern. I just want to point that out.
Is that
out.
Right?
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. She
we taught her everything she knows about
that's
acting.
That's right. Yeah. We taught her how to wear stilettos in a forest. I can tell you that.
She got that out of her system last summer.
She ignored that advice in this movie, which I'm ashamed to say.
Yeah, and this is her second movie in 2 years where she's dealing with giant lizards and little boys.
Yeah, well, that is interesting.
So I
hope
she's working on some
strange
kind of trilogy.
Going on there.
Is there another Godzilla that we can do? Put her in there?
There very well could be. But yeah, she's great in the movie. In a just world, she would be in a supporting actress conversation, I think.
Yeah.
That will never happen.
How about Pete? I feel like we're in an age where there's like just child acting generally has gotten so much better. Like,
yeah.
By huge amounts.
I think that people figured out what was going wrong in the 90s, where they all wanted
mugging.
Sort of Olsen twins, like they wanted precocious, and then they're like, no, we don't want it anymore. So they just want
by the right medication, too.
They're just heavily drugged. Don't look at their pupils too hard. It's a sad sight. The kid's name is Oakes Begley, which is like quite
good
a name. And it's a name I wouldn't mind like having kind of swirl through the aura season, like in the same way that Jacob Tremblay, like, sort of was fun to have last
year. It's hard for these child actors because you have to have a name that's not already taken, Screen Actors Guild. Yeah. That's why they always have these weirdo names.
Yeah.
Oaks Beckley,
because the
though,
parents
almost
are planning for their children to join the
Screen
Actors Guild.
I think change the names. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You can't just be Joe Smith. You know?
Oh, excuse me. It's Oaks Fegley.
Oaks Fegley.
Yeah.
See, Oaks Begley is probably already taken.
Oaks Begley Jr. is probably Ed Begley Jr.'s son or grandson. I don't know.
It was Elm Begley or Oaks Fegley. Exactly. He had to choose between those two.
Yeah.
But he looks a little bit like one of the kids from Stranger Things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't he?
And he's got the same similar, like he's not a first-time actor, this kid, Oaks. He's been in stuff before, but he's got that same Stranger Things vibe of like, oh, they just like found a kid and we're like, do you want to be in a movie? You know, like it's natural. It doesn't feel forced. Yeah. Which is like super important. And there's another girl or a girl in the movie kind of who plays his sort of counterpart who's been in stuff. She was in Southpaw. I think her name is Una something. She's more of a trained child actor, but she's also really good and like really natural. Mm-hmm. So something about this the direction of the movie kind of coaxes these easy lived in performances out of children, which is really hard to do.
And especially when you're acting opposite a CGI dragon. Who
wasn't
there.
Exactly. And this, the Oaks Fegley does a lot of that. I mean, there's a lot of just him and this, maybe it was a Andy Serkis type actor. I don't know, like doing kind of acting opposite him, but it's really convincing. Like he sells it, which is not, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen adults felled by that. Chris Pratt was felled by that in Guardians of the Galaxy, I thought sometimes. Like when he was talking to the raccoon, I was like, oh, you're just clearly just looking at like a block, like behind a green screen. You
know? Ping pong ball.
Yeah, exactly.
But Oaks really sells it.
Yes. I mean, I think it must have to do with like childhood and imagination. And, you know, he can kind of picture it in a way that adults kind of can't, which is what the movie is sort of about. So
he can make friends with Neil, what's his face, the Jungle Book kid, and they can commiserate about acting opposite hand puppets. And
In like 10 or 15 years, they can have a some sort of like, remember that crazy summer?
And little girl from the BFG.
Oh, yeah, the BFG. And there is a comparison to be made there, I think.
Yeah, they seem like similar stories, but the BFG, it seems like you think failed where Peace Dragon succeeded.
I think the BFG is so studious in its making and so kind of staid that it's just boring. And this movie maybe runs that risk, Peace Dragon, a little bit. But I think it finds the kind of fun and adventure and wonder. And I think also just having, you know, with BFG, like Roald Dahl is really hard source material to get right because it's so beloved and it's so good and it's so fun and kind of edgy and dark and weird. Peace Dragon was less of that. Like there was the degree of difficulty was lower, but I mean, BFG was,
you can let a little more air in. You're not hitting every single mark the entire time.
Absolutely. And BFG was like a rare bomb for Steven Spielberg this summer. It really did not do well. So maybe this can kind of course correct the summer live action / CGI children's movie genre. I don't know.
I'll be your candle on the water. My love for you will always burn. I know you're lost and drifting, but the clouds are lifting. Don't give up, you have somewhere to turn. I'll be your candle on the water, till every wave is warm and bright. My soul is there beside you. Let this candle guide you. Soon you'll see a golden stream of light. A cold and friendless tide has found you. Don't let the stormy darkness pull.
Speaking
you
of course correcting,
yeah.
How does Paul Verhoeven get from Starship Troopers to L, a kind of Oscar-y French
movie? I think Showgirls
movie.
Was in between those two.
Showgirls was 95, Starship Troopers was 2000, was 97.
Oh,
I'm just
really?
Happened to have this
I'm
open
sorry.
So we, more than one of us did our homework, turns out.
I was just testing you. I wanted to make sure you were prepared.
But Paul Verhoeven, the very talented but controversial director of Total Recall and RoboCop and Starship Troopers and Showgirls, is here with this movie that is very much a French art film, although at times it starts to feel almost like a parody of a French art film. But Isabelle Huppert?
Huppert, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a hell of a performance, right? This is like an unbelievable performance. I sound like Donald Trump.
I mean, it really is a great performance.
But this could be a Best Actress nomination.
Yeah. So this is a movie that was at Cannes, but I missed it because I had to be home. And it was like the last day of the festival. And you know, I think that when talking about this movie, obviously, you want to talk about Isabelle Huppert because she's amazing in it. But also the fact that Paul Verhoeven, before Showgirls, made Basic Instinct and a weird, crazy, sexualized thriller. And this movie is that, but French.
Yeah.
Because it's French, has that sort of more art housey vibe to it. And, you know, I was reading about the movie, about Elle. It's written by an American guy. And was originally supposed to be, so it's based on a French novel, but the script was written in English, was kind of, they were going to take it from Paris to New York. And when Verhoeven got involved, he was like, no, we have to put it back in Paris because no American actress would ever play a role this amoral. Mm-hmm. So enter Isabelle Huppert.
He might be right.
Who will do anything. And I don't know, he's totally right. I mean, I was trying to think of like an English-speaking actor or, you know, native English-speaking actress who could do this. And I was like, the only one I can think of is Nicole Kidman.
I read an interview too where he mentioned maybe Jennifer Jason Leigh would have been a possibility. Yeah.
That could have been interesting. Oh, that would have been a very different movie.
Yeah.
You know, Isabelle Huppert has a sort of glamour about her that I don't think Jennifer Jason Leigh has. And that glamour kind of works to good effect and creepy effect in the movie.
Yeah, fierce, and very sexual. And she's 63 years old.
Yeah,
I mean,
she's playing about 50.
Yeah, she's playing probably mid-50s maybe or something. Yeah. But so quickly, for those at home who have not read up on this or seen it, the setup is this woman in her 50s who runs a video game company and has a very, very fucked up family life. Is violently raped in her home. That's the very first thing that you see. And the way they present it in the kind of write-up of the film is she stalks her rapist, but it's like way more complicated than that and extremely morally and sexually complicated.
Yeah, reading up on it and then watching it are two vastly different experiences because there was some stuff about how it's kind of a revenge comedy. There was some stuff about how she's playing like a cat and mouse game with this guy. And I don't think that that's the movie at all.
It almost feels like the people marketing the movie were like, how? We can say this is a revenge fantasy, right? Even though it's what's happening in the movie is much weirder than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that I think beyond anything else, it's a provocation. It's like, it's kind of a movie about rape, but also a movie about movies about rape. You know, like it's really sort of questioning structures and how this stuff is presented in other films, in the same way that like a Michael Haneke movie like Funny Games kind of was like, oh, you like horror movies, well, here's a horror movie, you know. This is kind of asking that same question about you know, revenge fantasies or whatever.
Yeah.
And it throws you for a loop. But I, you know, I think that because Isabelle Huppert is so central and so commanding in it that you kind of trust her and you're like, all right, take me where you're going. I don't know about you guys, but I felt sort of tense and shocked by it, but I never felt like I was out of control, you know.
I agree. And what's interesting is they give her backstory is so dark that it kind of justifies everything and lets you say like maybe she would have actually, you know, behaved this way. I don't know.
I think that's the only backstory that they could have given that character in order for audiences not to say like why is she doing the things that she's doing.
Yeah. The other thing that's funny about it and a good reason to make it French is that it's a movie about adults and instead of a movie about kids and you know, dragons and all the rest of it, which America doesn't really do that much of anymore. We do that on TV.
Yeah.
And so, but the kind of promise of a movie about adults is you'll see, oh, this is how like sophisticated Parisians live. Like, I still think this is like a caricature of how sophisticated Parisians live, right? Like,
absolutely.
The whole thing is, it's sort of a farce.
Yeah.
Making fun of everything that's wrong with like bourgeois society.
Yeah.
Right?
And Verhoeven is not a French guy, you know, I think he's right. Dutch, right? So he is also an outsider looking into this kind of like glam Parisian life. Yeah, it absolutely. I think it's a farce of a lot of things, and it's also serious about a lot of things. And it's a really interesting mix. And I think, you know, Huppert is an actress who has been in the awards conversation for a lot of years. I think since like The Piano Teacher was like her big role 15 years ago, but has never been nominated and is really regarded. I mean, when you go to a festival like Cannes, when you talk to international journalists, she is regarded as the best actress in the world, like by many, many people, like beyond Meryl Streep, like but she's just never quite gotten that toehold in America for whatever reason.
Well, she sure has the material here. The only question is it too dark for the Academy? Which I don't know, it could be.
If Amour had difficulty penetrating into the conversation, and this is a billion times less marketable or commercial than that.
Yeah.
No, it's a tough sell.
I mean, it's Amour, though, was... People were afraid to watch it because it was just so relentlessly dark.
Yeah.
This one is more the setup. I was like not looking forward to it just given the setup. Like I don't like watching rape stuff personally. And then
it's an unusual position to
take. Right. And then, you know, but actually it's very entertaining and sort of mind blowing. But there is something about the Oscars where they tend to sort of get a little moralistic. Like, we can't really reward that, can we?
Right.
Like a movie that, I mean, just spoiler alert, like the whole crucial thing here is that you kind of get the feeling she likes it.
Yeah.
That's the whole issue that people are, you know, that also could become a weapon against it if somebody wants to start doing a little negative campaigning. That never happens in Hollywood.
Yeah.
But if somebody were to do the first negative campaign in history.
Many people are saying that this movie.
Many people are saying that she likes it.
Yeah. Well, I think my friend and colleague Guy Lodge, who's a film critic for Variety, when he reviewed it at L at Cannes, he was like, "It's." I think he called it like a think piece generating machine or something. I mean, like, if this movie
it's a
were,
troll.
If it was in English and more people saw it, this thing would blow people's minds and really set a conversation aflame. I don't know that it'll do that because it's in French and you know it's going to be kind of an art house release from Sony Pictures Classics, but. I do think that it's incendiary and sort of provocative enough that I think that Huppert has a really good shot at an Oscar nomination.
Yes, and if you can get people to watch it,
Well, they just need to tell gamers about it, and that'll get.
That's true. Yeah. There's a whole gamers hook in this.
She runs a video game company, and I think that they would probably have some opinions about how video games are depicted in the movie.
Yeah, not a super flattering depiction of video games
and the
either.
Culture around them.
Hmm. But I do think, you know, Actors Branch is obviously the biggest part of the Academy. Actors are going to look at this at some level amorally and say, holy shit, like that is just an unbelievable performance.
Yeah.
So for that reason alone, I think you could definitely see her getting a richly deserved nomination. And just to put herself through this at 63.
Yeah, it's wild and brave, and in a way that like, I hate using that word about acting, but like this is really brave. I mean, it's like it's wild what she does, and is you know, and she trusts Verhoeven to take her there, and they do something kind of remarkable together.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Yeah.
You know, and this movie isn't going to be out for a long time, but it is going to be at New York Film Festival.
Right.
Which is why we're kind of talking about it. And, you know, this is not Isabelle Huppert's only movie at the New York Film Festival. She also has a movie called Things to Come. So, you know, when we're talking about her Oscar chances, maybe she'll kind of cancel herself out. But, like, this other movie, Things to Come, is directed by Mia Hansen-Love, who made that movie Eden about the DJs that I loved
that's a great
last
movie.
Year. So mm-hmm. good. Mm-hmm. And it was at Berlin before it's going to be at New York Film Festival in October. And it got raves from Berlin. So, I mean, she could be a double contender. I don't know.
Yeah. But, or you could even imagine a world where... You know, sometimes they like to give the nomination for the less crazy mm-hmm. but a little more palatable one.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And
it stands for both, but like, don't make us nominate the rape movie where she may or may not like it.
Right. Marion Cotillard getting the nomination for 2 days, one night instead of the immigrant being kind of the tougher tale, you know, and the 2 days, one night being a little bit more palatable. Yeah. And the other Huppert movie, The Things to Come, is, you know, it's about a woman dealing with her mother's death. And my guess is that it's a little
seems
bit
more awards friendly.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, again, it's in French, so I don't know. You know, it's never that awards friendly, but yeah, I think of the two, although I would really like, I mean, I haven't seen Things to Come yet. I'm really excited to see it in Toronto. It'll be there before it's at New York Film Festival, but.
All right. So what else is at New York Film Festival that we need to have on our radars here?
Well, one of them is something we talked about last week, which is The Lost City of Z. That's the James Gray movie about people, explorers, that I think we edited it out of last week's episode, but I said that Brad Pitt was in it. He was at one point in it. He is now just producing it.
Okay.
But it's still Robert Pattinson's in it and Charlie Hunnam and a couple other people. So that's closing night. That'll be big. But I'm more excited about the opening night, which is the 13th, which is... Ava DuVernay, who directed Selma. It's a documentary that she made, kind of really just, I think, kind of all-encompassing about the civil rights struggle, and I think it refers to the 13th Amendment. So that's opening night of the festival, for that to be a documentary, that's pretty big.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I'm excited for that, and you know, it's been a good documentary year thus far, but this kind of should add to that. But on the scripted end, for our sort of Oscar-y purposes, the one I'm most excited about is a movie called 20th Century Women, which is directed by Mike Mills, who made that movie Beginners. That
love it,
Christopher Plummer,
and love all of his music videos. He's like a genius. Mike
Mills. He's kind of like Michel Gondry-esque, in that like he makes quirky stuff that's not annoyingly quirky.
Yeah,
you know, it kind of works. So I don't know much about the plot of the movie, but I know Annette Bening is in it, and I know that a friend of mine who lives in Los Angeles and sees things way earlier than I do, than most of us do, saw it and said it's fantastic.
I will say that the description made me roll my eyes a tiny bit. It was something like three different women like help a young boy learn about life and love in the summer of 1979, which sounds...
What could possibly be wrong with that, Hillary? Come on.
Sounds like a story that's never been told.
Yeah, okay.
I'm just glad the women are helping a boy. That's
yes,
that's
exactly.
Really, what
it's got to be his story.
Right.
We have to make sure that we tell a boy's coming of age.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And Annette Bening plays the dragon. Right.
Eventually, she has to let him go so that she can fly off and help another boy.
Yeah.
All right,
but you know,
not pass the Bechdel test.
Maybe not.
One.
But
that's okay.
But Mills,
I'm sure it's better than the description makes it sound.
Yeah, I mean, this, you know, again, like with Elle, for example,
that description was just written to get the old guys who have the money to green light it. Then there's a whole other thing going on.
You had me
in the movie.
A boy.
Right, yeah. Women help a boy?
1979. I was alive then.
Yeah.
Exactly. But, you know, Mills does have an Oscar history now, you know, with Christopher Plummer. So,
yes.
So that's kind of exciting.
And Thumbsucker also was his previous film, which is also great,
yeah, of course,
based on a novel by Walter Kern, another Vanity Fair.
Intern?
Former, not intern, writer. Actually, might have been. He was a writer for us.
Yeah.
I'm here to just throw in all the Vanity Fair
references. No, I like that. That's good. It's, you know, just, it you have to remind the listener of the brand, you know, just
that's right.
as often as possible. So I'm excited about that. And then I would say the other one that's, well, I mean, I should mention that it's a lot of Cannes stuff. It's Elle, it's Tony Erdmann, a German movie that people love, the Dardenne brothers movie, The Unknown Girl, and my favorite out of Cannes, Personal Shopper, the Kristen Stewart movie directed by Olivier Assayas, really freaking weird, but is great. So there's a lot
and
of that.
Kind of a follow-up to Clouds of Sils Maria or whatever. Same two people.
Yeah, and she plays a similar role. She's an assistant in both of them, basically.
Right.
And it's a real wackadoodle movie. But
and what about Kenny Lonergan?
Well, yeah. So Kenneth Lonergan, Manchester by the Sea, which was at Sundance.
That's making its slow march.
Yeah.
Maybe the Kodak Theater or wherever they do it these days.
So, yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, and the interesting thing about that movie is that it's playing all these festivals and is getting lauded as a big Oscar hope, and it is, but it's also an Amazon movie, so it's mm-hmm. going to be released theatrically, but also be on Amazon.
Yeah, that was something that stuck out to me when I was going through the film festival lineup, is just how many movies had Amazon or Netflix after their names, mm-hmm. after their descriptions.
Yeah, I mean, it's the brave new world, you know, and we'll see what works. I mean, you know, last year, I think, was kind of the test year with Beasts of No Nation mm-hmm. and Chirac to see, can... you know, streaming movies make it in the awards conversation. Beast of Nation got there to some extent, but I think, you know, this year...
My understanding is voters were actively hostile to mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. idea.
Yeah.
Really didn't like the idea at all, but that's might just be one of those things that happens the first year and then they are going to give in. They also added more people than
first
they've
ever added
before.
First they ignore you.
Yeah,
then
exactly.
they laugh at you.
Sure. Then you win. A few more steps in there. But yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, at some point, there's just the brute force of... good releases mm-hmm. is gonna break that tide. That seems just like a silly dead ender mentality, but sometimes people like to have their little protests.
Yeah, sure. And you know, I think that we can stand athwart history yelling stop as long as we want, but it's gonna happen.
Well, I also just don't understand why, like, I actually have no idea what their actual objection could be.
I think it's a financial one.
Yeah, because you don't buy tickets to see these movies. You buy a subscription to a service or already have a subscription to a service, so they aren't getting, you know, box office out of it.
Right.
I think it's the same people who go like CinemaCon for mm-hmm. like the you know, the
theater
owners, you know, and who are like, well, that's shitty for our bottom line. Even though these are getting theatrical releases, it's mm-hmm. just kind of presented right. you with the option of.
But they also get those very dutiful, like, it mm-hmm. showed for 3 days at the Arclight, so right. mm-hmm. therefore
so it qualifies.
It's an Oscar-qualified run.
Uh-huh, exactly. Uh-huh. And, you know, Manchester by the Sea is long and sad, and it doesn't need to be seen on a big screen, honestly. And, you know, I mean, I finally realized, like, months after seeing it, that, like, I was in a bad mood for 2 days after seeing that movie. Not like in a bad way. I was just kind of depressed because it's a really sad movie. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, it's because I saw that movie and it was like snowy and cold. And I was like, you know.
It's great marketing for Manchester by the Sea.
Yeah. No, it's really good.
Michelle Williams.
2 day depression,
right?
Guaranteed.
Michelle Williams is in it, yes. And she's not in many scenes, but she has one scene that I think won her the Oscar already.
Yeah.
For Best Supporting Actress.
Boom.
I haven't seen any of the other big fall movies, so who the hell knows?
Okay.
But if the Oscars were tomorrow, absolutely.
It's her like network moment.
Absolutely. In a walk, she has this one scene toward the end of the movie, and she and Casey Affleck are spouses, and they are confronting some really difficult past in the scene, and it's just, I mean, she blows out of the water.
Well, that's a tried and true way to win supporting.
Sure mm-hmm. is.
Is yeah. one scene. You don't really need to do very much.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it's like Anne Hathaway and Les Mis.
Yeah, and it's exactly like Anne Hathaway and Les Mis. It's exactly like Beatrice Straight in Network. That's all you need, and she's really good in it. And it's a testament to her performance that like she's such a small part, but like for days afterward in Utah, like everyone's like, "Oh, did you see Michelle Williams in that movie?" You know, and even though you know Casey Affleck, who also will be nominated, I'm pretty sure, is great. She really stands out.
Would you ever thought watching Dawson's Creek a million years ago that Michelle Williams would be this like serious Oscar-y actress? Yeah.
No. Dawson's Creek did not show anybody at their best, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, few people will remember this, but Michelle Williams, before Dawson's Creek, had a small role in the movie Species, about a sort of alien hybrid human who grows up to be Natasha Henstridge.
Who grows up to be James Vanderbeek.
Yeah, right, yeah. But Michelle Williams was in that as playing the sort of teenage alien. And back when I was still pretending to have crushes on girls, uh-huh. she was in my middle school very public crush was Michelle Williams.
Michelle Williams. You're like, guys, I love like, Michelle
she's
Williams.
So beautiful.
The sensitive boy's choice.
Yeah, so I've been rooting for her for 20 years.
So you're slightly in the tank for Michelle.
I am.
What you're saying you should take the best supporting actress thing with a slight grain of salt.
Yeah, yeah, well, so we'll see. But I'm just pretending to, Leah. is there anything on this list, on these New York Film Festival, that you guys are particularly excited about? Because, like, I mean, I've seen a bunch of these Cannes things, or does anything jump out at you when you looked at the list? Or
Something that stood out to me that we haven't mentioned yet is Patterson, the Adam Driver plays a bus driver mm-hmm. movie.
The Jim Jarmusch.
Yeah. Which just seems like the Adam Driveriest thing I can possibly think of.
It's a very chicken and egg kind of movie. It's like, did Adam, what came first here? Like, this role, Adam Driver, what? Yeah, and it's really good.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really good movie. It's a really nice film that was at Cannes. I am happy to see it on this list. I think it's also maybe going to be at one of the other festivals.
Toronto, maybe?
I think it might be at Toronto. And it's really interesting because it's getting the kind of, it seems to be getting the Oscar-y push that it didn't seem like it would in May. But I think that they know that they have something great. So it could be a big year for Adam Driver.
Like a best actor for him, possibly?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really, it's a small movie and it's a very understated role. But he plays it beautifully. And I think if nothing else, it will put him in that conversation for the next role.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So now he's got the big box office clout.
Episode 8.
Well, exactly.
Or 9? Where are we?
8. It'll be 8, yeah. He's got the box office clout because of Star Wars. And now he's got this indie film cred. He had it a little bit before, but like this.
And
really,
the last season of Girls has, I think, finished filming.
Right,
so
there
he's
you go.
Free.
So he's a free man. So I think that'll be interesting. And I think that watching that movie play out at the festivals and see how people respond to it will be really interesting, in the same way that it's going to be interesting to see what Birth of a Nation does at Toronto. And I've said, I think, on this podcast before that if that movie plays well at Toronto, I think it has it sewn up.
Yeah.
Best picture. So,
yeah.
You know, that's why these fall festivals are fun, because you both see new things, but also see older stuff that now gets seen by more people.
It's having its moment. Yeah.
Yeah.
The rest of us get to see them.
Yeah.
I want to see certain women that Kelly Reichardt. I'm such a huge fan of hers.
Yeah.
And speaking of Michelle Williams and speaking of Kristen Stewart.
Yeah.
So
they're both doubling up at this festival.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm excited for that. I think everything that director does is pretty much cool.
Yeah. It's an interesting movie. And Kristen Stewart's segment of it's a kind of a triptych of three different stories. It's based on a short story author's collection. Kristen Stewart's storyline is really great, and she's really great in it.
Yeah.
And,
what about this Ken Loach thing? I mean, is there any, like, does that have any Oscar potential, or is that just like a made for Cannes type of a deal? So this is the film that won the Palme d'Or, right?
Yeah.
Daniel Blake. And it's like a working class
social
drama,
realism,
right? Social
kind
realism
of,
drama?
Yeah. Yeah. And kind of came out of nowhere in a little bit to win the Palme d'Or at Cannes. But he's won twice before, so it shouldn't have been that much of a surprise.
Right.
You know, I don't know. There's no one of name in it. Like,
it doesn't have any
there.
Oscar glamour, right?
No.
It's a very Cannes, like, we still remember the...
It's going to be like, you got to see that
Third
movie
Republic.
To have seen all the movies of 2016. Like, it's going to be like, have you seen The Loach? You know, it's I think that's going to be it.
Got to catch them all.
Yeah, right. So, very, very staid, depressing.
My contribution
Pokemon
to this conversation.
Thank you. Bring in the Pokemon references.
Yeah, I think it's going to be kind of vegetables, but I mean, but that's not to say they're bad. It's just, It's just, you know, I think
it's just vegetables.
It's just
steamed
vegetables
with no salt.
British, you know, they're just the British way. So
the mushy peas of the film slate.
Right, exactly.
The watery tea and mushy. Okay, sorry, sorry, Mr.
Roach. Metaphor has gotten away from us.
Yeah.
And before we leave New York,
the
film
warm
festival,
ale. Sorry, I'm done. I'm stopped.
The bubble and squeak.
Ooh,
that's such a gross term. The last movie I wanted to mention, it's a new one that I haven't seen. I know one person who saw it in a long lead screening was Moonlight, which is not really on many radars yet. It's a movie by a director named Barry Jenkins. It is about a gay black or a black kid in America who's figuring out that he's gay, which is not a topic that is often covered in films. Which I'm really excited about. It has a good cast that of Naomi Harris, Marshall Ali from House of Cards, Janelle Monáe is in it, Andre Holland. You know, so it's a really interesting cast. And it a friend of mine who has seen it texted me right after he got out of the screening. He was like, "Moonlight, keep an eye on that one. It's really, really great." So I'm excited about that. And I had actually emailed the publicist about, like, is it going to be at any of the fall festivals? And she was kind of coy. And then the next day it was announced that it was going to be at New York Film Festival, which is a good
sign. All right.
Yeah.
Moonlight.
Yeah. They don't
glad there's something new for you to see.
Yeah. Well, and
New
York Film Festival doesn't premiere a lot of movies. So, so
I love New York Film Festival.
It's great. It's at Lincoln Center.
Cool.
It's cool. It's in the fall. It's, you know, you're waiting in line, but it's not too hot. You know, it's a good, it's a good time.
Yep.
I'll see you.
All right, friends and neighbors, this is Jen Lindley, and I'm signing off for the summer. But it's been a blast. I've really enjoyed sharing music that I like and having this opportunity to vent. So I guess what I'm trying to say is thank you all for listening, and I'll catch you on the flip side.
Thank you.
Now I'm really excited for Oscar season, and I want to go back in time, way back to when probably, I don't know, I was born. Hillary definitely wasn't born. I don't know about Richard.
Sam, can we underscore this with the theme song?
Yeah.
The Vangelis.
I feel like I got the year wrong here because I'm seeing that Atlantic City was 1980, actually.
It was the 81 Oscars.
It was the 54th Academy Awards presented on March 29th, 1982. All right, whatever. So it was the year...
82 Oscars, movies of 81.
Movies of 81.
Yeah.
Except for Atlantic City, which apparently came out in 80. But anyway, Chariots of Fire won.
And it was a surprise win.
Surprise win. And yeah, Richard, do you want to take us through this? Take us through this.
So my understanding is that it was a surprise win because it was this tiny, it was like a kind of indie film from Britain that about track runners, you know, at the 1924 Olympics, which is why we're talking about it
today,
because of the Olympics. And a lot of people thought that Reds was going to win, this big sweeping historical epic from Warren Beatty that got a billion nominations and, you know, is a very good movie.
Vanity Fair has done a whole making of Reds and has never done a making of Chariots of Fire.
Just there you
another
go.
Signifier. There you go. And to finish my Vanity Fair flashback references and of this episode.
Yeah, and there you know, it's Reds is sort of a VF kind of movie.
Yeah.
And it was at the time certainly a very Oscar-y movie. And then not that Chariots of Fire was, and it's a sweeping period drama, you know. But like it was kind of the scrappy little thing, and it was a movie about scrappy people, you know, so it kind of the narrative sort of dovetailed well into a win. But I guess the question for us is, do we think it deserved it? You know, do you want to run down who else was nominated?
It was Chariots of Fire, Atlantic City, the Louis Malle film.
Yeah, great movie.
On Golden Pond, which you'll remember, Jane Fonda. And all
the loons, Norman, the loons.
Yeah. Raiders, a little tiny film called Raiders of the Lost Ark that no one remembers at all.
Yep.
And Reds, the Warren Beatty prestige drama.
Yeah.
About communists in House on American Activity, communist world
before that,
pre.
Diane Keaton, great movie.
Yeah.
I would say
Chariots of Fire. Really, all anyone remembers is the song.
Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah.
the score. It's a good movie. Mm-hmm. You know, I watched it as a kid because my mom was into it, and you know, and she was my mom.
I think it was on when I was a kid. It was on like Cinemax all day, every day.
Sure. Yeah.
It was just that, and then Raiders of the Lost Ark. They just loop back and forth.
Right. If I had to kind of retcon it, I mean, I like Atlantic City quite a bit. That's a great with Burt Lancaster and Susan Sarandon. A movie that was sort of put on the TV in front of me by my parents, and I was like, and I usually resisted that, but that one I was like, oh, this is actually really good. But I would give it to Raiders. I mean,
Of the five, it's had the most staying power.
And I think that it what it's trying to do, it does exactly perfectly. And I think that is enough of a criteria for
Mike, I feel like you're disagreeing.
I mean, it's a pokey little movie. I mean, if you go back to it, the wheels are a little shaky on that movie. Like, it's a lot of fun. And I think it was almost intentionally done that way. Because it was supposed to be like one of these old serials, the things that, like, you'd go back in the old days, the little movies that ran before a movie. Steven Spielberg was trying to recapture that and make a whole feature out of it. I don't know. I mean, I guess maybe there's a snob in me that's just like, there's some shit in that movie that's just like, you can see the rafter, the whatever.
The strings. You can see
you can see the strings.
You don't think that the face melting is up to par?
Yeah. I mean, it's brilliant and inspired and incredible. I mean, and Harrison Ford doing his, like, is he acting or not? Like, you know what I mean? Did he just get the seconds ago?
They didn't tell him he was in a movie. That's the trick.
What Harrison Ford does on his off time.
George Lucas went on this crazy adventure.
Yeah. I always think of, like, you can type these lines, but you can't say them his sort of acting approach to acting.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I would do it. I think it, what for what it's trying to be, it does it perfectly. It's indelible. It's great. Yeah. I'm
okay.
And it's kind of a corrective for not giving it to Star Wars 4 years earlier.
Yeah. I think the one that I would want to watch most right now, I mean, I like Raiders anytime, but I think what I'd want to watch most right now is Atlantic City. That's the one where I would be like, let's get in and let's like, this will be fun.
Yeah.
Rather than like so heavy. Some of the other ones are just.
Yeah. Or on Golden Pond, which is just Melts Fest.
Hillary?
I was born in 1988, I feel like I should maybe recuse myself from this
discussion.
No, you
can't. Wrong.
I mean,
go for it.
I have to admit that Raiders is the one that I have seen of these five movies.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Maybe that's, although I feel like I would probably love On Golden Bond, honestly. Oh,
it's, On Golden Bond is good, and it also introduces us, I believe it's the first cinematic capturing of the phrase suck face when making out. And so like a teenage boy says it, and then Henry Fonda says it.
Automatic Oscar.
Yeah. He says to Katharine Hepburn, "You want to suck face." At one point in that movie. So,
all right, I gotta go.
I'm surprised they haven't remade On Golden Pond with Jane Fonda in the Katharine Hepburn role.
Oh, that's kind of
right. That's in the works. Like, yeah.
They did a stage version with James Earl Jones and I think either Leslie Uggams or Cecily Tyson a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. That actually was pretty well received. But yeah, I think you're right. The cinematic Fonda continuation saga is going to happen.
Okay. Well, I'm fine with that. Happening. I don't know. Atlantic City. I want to watch it tonight. It's been a long time.
It's been a few years. It's a good one.
What happens in Atlantic City?
Oh, it's sort of like a thrillery sort of a thing. And Susan Sarandon plays a young casino worker. And I remember she says she's learning French and she's like, well, it's the international language of diplomacy, which dates that movie considerably. And Burt Lancaster's what, like a private eye or somebody?
Yeah, something like that.
It's like a whole kind of into the night kind of adventure thriller thing. It's good.
Well, that about does it for this episode of Little Gold Men. Thank you so much for joining us. You can find all of us writing about awards and, in my case, too much Donald Trump on VF.com and on Twitter. I'm Mike_Hogan. Richard.
Rylaws.
And Hillary.
Hillabuster with two R's.
Hillabuster. and two L's.
And two L's, yes.
And two L's. This episode was edited by Tim Einenkel and produced by Sam Dingman. As always, we thank Laura Mayer and Andy Bowers at Panoply. Please, please go to our iTunes page and follow us and rate us and leave a glowing review and then send an email to everyone you know.
Yeah.
Demanding that they do the same because that is how this thing works. And the award for the thing we hope you don't say when you read our description on iTunes goes to Hillary Busis.
I will say that the description made me roll my eyes a tiny bit.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.